This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and the show today is very important to me and close to my heart. So not only am I passionate about the subject, but this is also deeply personal for me. All of this to say, I'm so grateful to have Avi Abraham Ben-Lolo on the program today to talk about his excellent, just-released book called Never Surrender, Countering Denial, Distortion, and Complicity. Before we meet him, let me tell you a little bit more about him. Avi Abraham Ben-Lolo is the nation's most prominent and noted expert in Holocaust studies, countering worldwide anti-Semitism and promoting human rights. In recognition of his humanitarian efforts, he has received numerous awards, including an honorary doctorate from a prestigious Israeli university, an Order of Vaughan for his distinguished contribution to equity and diversity, the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Award for contributions to Canada, and a Race Relations Award for best practice based on distinguished service in promoting human rights. His proudest achievement is in support of Israel is the establishment of the Avi Ben-Lolo Scholarship Fund in National Security Studies at Haifa University. He is sought after by the media, writes a weekly highly read article in the National Post newspaper, and is frequently interviewed all over the world. And as just mentioned, he's here today to talk about his new book, Never Surrender, Countering Denial, Distortion, and Complicity. The book is brilliant, and I'm looking forward to unpacking it and a lot more with him today on the program. Avi Ben-Lolo, it's an honor to have you here. Welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you, Judy. It's an honor to be here.
Avi, it feels like the world has gone crazy. What is happening on 200 college campuses is frightening and out of control, not only for the Jewish people, but for all people. And before we get into all of that, I want to start with what you wrote in the introduction of your book. You wrote that innocence ended on October 7th, 2023. Unprovoked, Hamas attacked Israel, brutally murdering 1,200 people in a matter of hours. It was the largest, most significant murderous campaign of pure evil since the Holocaust. Up until that moment, Israelis felt safe and secure, believing they were protected. Soon after, despite these heinous crimes, the international community began turning on Israel and anti-Semitism surged across the globe. That was all a quote, by the way. You go on to say that those with open eyes recognize that this is not only a fight against Israel, but against freedom and democracy itself. We are looking for a beacon of light and hope. And I have to tell you, Avi, that your book, Never Surrender, is the first time I have felt even a vestige of that in these deeply frightening and troubled times. Like many others, this is reverberating pretty intensely for me. I have so many questions for you about how and why this happened, how the hostages can be released, what happened to create this worldwide torrent of anti-Semitism. But before we get to any of that, I want to talk about something that just happened. This is a live news story that is happening right now that you actually foreshadowed quite brilliantly in your book. And that is the escalating, oftentimes violent, pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses all across North America and Europe, which have been described as pro-Hamas demonstrations that are not at all peaceful. There have been violent scenes, arrests, particularly at Columbia University, where I believe 300 people got arrested last night at 4 a.m, where clearly the administration completely lost control of their campus. Terrible problems at UCLA ongoing right now. There's also problems right here in Canada, including McGill University in Montreal, right here in Toronto. These protests are targeting Jewish students. They're blatantly anti-Semitic. Jewish students being barricaded. I don't want to go on, but people being terrorized, and even the Jewish students at Columbia were told to leave the campus and continue doing online learning. How would you describe what is going on? Would you have ever believed, Avi, that things could escalate to this degree? Can you say more?
Well, yeah, thank you for that question. Yeah. Look, this has been going on actually for 20 plus years. We've seen on university campuses, actually began in Toronto at the University of Toronto what was called Israeli Apartheid Week and then the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction campaigns. So in fact, what we're seeing to now is actually the manifestation of that in a bigger way. They've been building momentum, ingraining themselves on universities systematically, really becoming institutional and the universities themselves. And we say, you know, when you said the administrations have failed to, you know, to deal with this, that's because the administrations have been complicit all of these years. They're now pretending not to have been, but they have been complicit and they've ignored all of these years our warnings. And I can tell you, you know, having been an activist for the last 20 plus years and speaking to president after president and communicating back and forth with universities, they always use the language of free speech and they always denied and they distorted and so forth. And so what we are seeing right now play out is a manifestation of what was planted in those decades preceding this. And they were waiting for this moment to happen. And what's important to understand as well right now is that this is more than just about the Gaza war or the pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas movements. Those are being used as reasons. But now, in fact, I think, and what I just wrote about for my article in tomorrow's National Post, is that this is essentially now a group of anarchists who are anti-capitalist, anti-Western values, who have planted themselves into this movement that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're comprised of, you know, what people would call socialists and Marxists. It's a mishmash of many, many, many groups who have been disenfranchised, marginalized in society and have felt that that's what they are. And so for them, this is a cause. And you'll see many of the students and many of the faculty they're not Palestinian. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're not Palestinian. And, you know, and they would never, ever step foot in Gaza. Yeah. They would never, ever be welcomed. Mm-hmm. Many of them are gay. Many of them are feminists. They would never be welcomed in Gaza. They would be immediately thrown off rooftops for their beliefs by Hamas. But yet they're aligning themselves with Hamas. Why? Because it suits them, their need to undermine the very values of democracy, Western Judeo-Christian values that have been built up. That is what they are attempting to do.
I'm also sensing, and from being glued to Instagram and TikTok and the news media, the regular news media, that these protests, which are on 200 college campuses right now, all across North America, even in Europe, that this is not just comprised of students and administration, faculty, that there are agitators there. There are other people, other individuals who've been hired, from what I understand. Can you say more about that to add to the field? In fact, of the many people that were arrested at Columbia, my understanding is a huge amount, close to 50%, were not even students. They were these agitators and these other people that you're talking about. Is someone paying them? I've heard all kinds of things that Qatar is not only paying the university administrations millions and billions of dollars a year, which is why the universities are having a hard time saying no to all of this. But in addition to that, they're paying these agitators to be there. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've known for years, again, going back to what I said before, the Israeli apartheids and the BDS campaigns have all been funded and supported by many institutions that are pro-Palestinian and are undermining these things. So we know that they exist. And that was already the foothold that was in place and ready to go for this. It's obviously been we've seen it in pictures. How is it possible that, you know, you see the same tents in every single location? It's the same brand, it's the same color, it's the same tent. How are all these students getting the same tent? Mm-hmm. Obviously, someone is buying them. Obviously, someone is funding us. Obviously, someone is paying for this campaign. So now it's becoming very, very clear that this is what's happening. Many of the people that are being arrested are not part of the university, and they are the agitators. They are professional campaigners who are being paid by organizations to go in, to agitate the students, to recruit, you know, and to provide them with the resources that they need to do this work. That's what's taking place. And so, you know, our universities, in fact, are being overtaken. They're no longer our universities. And I say our, I mean, you know, Western societal universities. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that there are currently many of them, because they're funded by Qatar and other countries, they have been now overtaken. And that is the strategy that I was expressing before. It's a strategy. If we can steal the young people of your nation, if we can, you know, re-educate the young people,
oh my God,
we can change the fabric of your society. We can change the fabric of your democracy and your identity. And that is what they're actually succeeding in doing it. It's a brilliant campaign when you think about it. If you stand aside and you really think about it, how do you change a society? You change it from the young people. You don't change it from the old people. So that's exactly what's been happening for more than 20 years. And it's been allowed to happen. Columbia University has had many instances of anti-Semitism and problematic people, mm-hmm. you know, as Americans will tell you. And so have other universities. So this is what the danger is. And what I'm trying to do in my work and in my book is I'm really trying to tell beyond the Jewish community. I'm trying to tell the non-Jewish community, guys, you got to wake up. This is what's happening. You know, we're right now the first target. The Jewish community is the first target, okay? But it's not going to stop there. No. And your society is going to change. And before you know it, you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to say, what happened? Where is our freedom and our democracy? Our laws are being changed, you know? And there's suddenly principles that our nation is undertaking that are not in line with what our foundation principles had been. And that should be a major concern for all of society.
Well, we've even seen vestiges of this already, haven't we, with the American flag being dropped down and replaced by the Palestinian flag. Like, Americans don't like that. That was not a good moment. And I'm wondering if images like that are, you know, reaching the American people and the North American people. Like, what do you think mm-hmm. about that? Because that's like...
I actually think in America, the more they conduct themselves this way, the more there will be a boomerang effect on them. Americans, and you're absolutely right, Judy, Americans will not tolerate a threat to their flag.
No.
And they will speak out, and they will speak out very, very forcefully. They will also act out. So those people, in a way, I'm going, oh, you know what? Maybe it's a wake-up call for America to understand really what's going on. And the more they see those keffiyehs, which symbolize terrorism, the more they see the flags being taken down, the more they see broken windows and doors on their campuses and shoving and so forth, the more Americans will stand up and fight this. Mm-hmm. And this will be detrimental to these pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas people. Canada is different. And Canada, I'm very concerned about, because Canadians don't have the same attitude. We have a weaker identity as a nation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're much more so-called tolerant mm-hmm. of this kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. Our politicians, authority figures tend to look the other way. And so that is dangerous. It's more dangerous in Canada than it is in America.
It feels like it's become like just out of control anarchy. And it's very terrorizing, certainly for the Jewish students, some of who have had to leave campus. I just heard that Columbia's canceled graduation. And I feel like Canadian campuses have even less control over it. What happened at McGill?
Look, I mean, I'll tell you something. The first reaction of McGill president, I was fairly happy with, to say, I'm calling in the police to clear them out. That was the right reaction, and that was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But now, since then, the police have obviously not taken action. There was an injunction that was supposed to happen in the courts. That failed, unfortunately. So that reinforces these encampments. And so now, you know, the McGill is now, you know, blossomed into UBC. U of T now is setting up camps. And the threat is, of course, all over the country. It will, of course, result in cancellation of graduations, which will impact the student body at large. And so that is a massive problem for the universities, and I think for the general society, not just the Jewish community.
How are we going to fix this? Like, this just feels very out of control and very scary. You are an optimist and you are a person with hope, if I'm reading you correctly.
Yeah.
Where is this going? How do we fix this?
Yeah, well, number one is I am an optimist. Actually, I spoke about that yesterday. We had an event for the book yesterday, and I did say that. So number one, in terms of optimism, I do believe that we're going to overcome this. Why? Because we've overcome Hitler. We've overcome every other issue throughout our 2,000 years of persecution. So this is just another issue in our generation, which we, and I'm talking about we as the Jewish community, will overcome. In Israel, we'll overcome that. And Israel is itself, you know, they could scream and yell here. They can put up their tents and do their encampments, but it's not going to change. And maybe they're listening, and I hope they will listen to this. It's not going to change anything. Why? Because what Hamas did on October 7th, okay, even left-wing Jews, okay, yes, have changed their minds. And I've spoken to left-wing Jewish leaders who were, you know, peace activists and are still peace activists, but they were green activists, and they were, all of them say one thing in unison: Hamas needs to be dismantled. Even if there's a ceasefire tomorrow, and even, you know, Hamas will be dismantled. So they can have all their encampments, they can rally the universities, and the universities, you know, if they die, if they so-called divest from Israel, it's not going to harm Israel. Believe me, Israel's strong, and it's got a lot of supporters. Mm-hmm. So when I'm an optimist, I'm an optimist from the side of strength. Mm-hmm. Knowing the resilience of the Jewish people, knowing that we're not going to tolerate Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran or any one of those nations, and knowing that we're not going to tolerate denial and complicity, people who want to say the rapes of Jewish women didn't happen, we're not going to tolerate any of that. We're done. Mm-hmm. So our innocence, you know, I started the first words in my book is, it's the end of the innocence. Yeah. We were tolerating all of that. Mm-hmm. We actually were tolerating all of that. Mm-hmm. And October 7th, in the Jewish psyche that has gone through the Holocaust, you know, that has gone through history of pogroms, of
Spanish Inquisition, and
of Crusades, all of those things, it's all within our psyche, and the rest of the world may not understand it, but we do. And they can have all their encampments. Very good. Good for you. It's not going to change anything on the ground in Israel.
That's good to know. I mean, Iran attacked Israel. That has never happened ever before. Between Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, like, are Israelis safe in Israel right now?
I think Israelis are more safe than Jews are anywhere else in the world. That's why today what we're seeing is an influx of Jews making Aliyah. You would think the reverse is true. Jews are thinking about moving to Israel. Yeah. Jews are buying up property in Israel. Yeah. Okay, because we see that if things continue this way, it will be very dangerous for us in many of the places that we're residing in. We're trying to change the course of history here. We're working hard at doing that, and we're hopeful, and we have to continue fighting that. But at the same time, Israel is really our safety net. And it's not a surprise that most Jews are really looking at Israel. And, you know, and I'll tell you one other thing on that point. Since October 7th, Jews have strengthened their Zionism. Mm-hmm. What is Zionism? Zionism is our right to come home to our homeland, mm-hmm. to have a homeland. Okay, that's all Zionism mm-hmm. is. And so we have strengthened, our young people are more Jewish today. Yeah. Here on campuses and everywhere else than they ever were before October 7th. Okay, we are funding Israel more than ever. We're pouring in money into Israel. So we're wearing our Magen Davids. You know, I met a doctor here in Toronto who every day goes into work with a tie emblazoned with the Magen David. Wow. And I said to him, "You walk around the halls like this at your hospital?" He goes, "Absolutely, since October 7th, yeah. every single day." And I go, "You see patients?" And he goes, "Absolutely, every single day." So, you know, this is what October 7th did.
Yes, but I'm going to say something about that. There is this whole theory out there, be loud and proud. But there's also this theory of being afraid to be loud and proud. Avi, what do you suggest?
Yeah, look, I mean, don't risk your life, but it would be actually against Jewish tradition to do that. But I would say be loud and proud, you know, and I'll tell you one other thing. I have a lot of friends outside of the Jewish community, a lot of very close Christian and Muslim friends mm-hmm. who are themselves loud and proud. Mm-hmm. And so they are there with us every single
That's
day.
True.
And so we have to embrace that, welcome it, and by wearing Magen Davids and by being out there vocally, we're just reinforcing that message. We can't, you know, we can't hide. We shouldn't hide.
I love that you mentioned Christians because, you know, I actually have a best friend who is Irish Catholic, who on October 8th posted, "I stand with Israel," based on something that I posted about Noah Tishby. And it was so touching to me that she did that. And there was a huge parade in New York City that was populated by nuns and priests and Christian people standing alongside us. And you even mentioned in the book the Pope's support of Israel. Can you tell us more about the Pope and his...
Yeah. The visit was exactly last year at this time. And, wow. And the Pope invited me to join him. And I got there and I wasn't sure what to expect. And he was conducting mass outside in St. Peter's Square, and he actually sat me right beside him, which was a massive honor. I mean, I was sitting in this mass of thousands of people, okay, and they brought me onto the stage to sit right beside him.
Wow.
And it was very touching. And then after the mass, he came right up to me to bring greetings, and I gave him a gift, a menorah. And it was really a very meaningful exchange of understanding of our interfaith unity and how our history together is so important, and how together we can really make the world a better place if we just all work together. And I say that as well to my Muslim friends, and I've got many, and they all, you know, we talk all the time. Yeah. So the world hasn't been as divided as you might, as some people might
right.
think. Actually, a lot of people have come together of different groups, and we're all talking about these things. And so I really believe that after this war and after all is said and done, actually, Israel will be in a much better place. The Abraham Accords will be strengthened. Israel will make peace with Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. no question about it. The Saudis are looking at what Hamas is doing. The UAE is looking at what Hamas is doing and saying this is not right. This is not the future for anyone right. in the Middle East. So, you know, it's gonna be unfortunate. You know, it may look bad right now, but it's gonna all come together.
Can you speak for a moment, Avi, about the Abraham Accord for my listeners that may not be familiar with it? What's it all about?
Well, the Abraham Accords, I think, were one of the most significant moments over the last 3 years. Started actually, what are we, in 2020, 2019, 2020.
COVID, yeah.
Under the Trump administration, whatever you think of Donald Trump, and I know everybody thinks very differently and has different views, so it's not really a political point. But one of the significant things that his administration did do is bring together Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, Bahrain, Sudan, under what they called the Abraham Accords, and being of the Abrahamic faiths, right? It's really a faith-based perspective to say, look, we all come from the same place, from the same prophets, from the same region. We have obviously some disagreements that are political. Let's leave those disagreements aside and start working together and talking together. And as soon as those Abraham Accords were signed on the White House lawn, you know, magic started to happen. You know, the Jewish and the Arab world was so optimistic in that region. Billions of dollars of trade started to flow back and forth. Today, there's like 5 or 6 flights from Dubai to Tel Aviv and still happening. And so the potential is massive. And then if you think of Saudi Arabia, which was this close to coming on board, if Saudi Arabia signs on to it, that will open up the rest of the Arab Muslim world mm-hmm. to this peace process. And that then will open up the entire region. And, you know, Israel's an open society. The Muslim communities, you know, they start coming to Israel. They start coming to the mosques in Israel, to Jerusalem, to worship. And they're more than welcome to do it. And so this incredible, optimistic, you know, agreement, and Morocco as well. Morocco, in fact, that there's a huge amount of trade and tourism that's happening between Israel and Morocco. Mm-hmm. Now things have slowed down because of this war and things, but they're not completely done. There's still trade, there's still discussion mm-hmm. that is happening, and that will expand following the war. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one other thing, Judy, which is interesting. So the reason, I mean, you know, my organization, Abraham Global Peace Initiative, one of the reasons we called it Abraham is because of the Accords, but also because we wanted Canadians to know about it. When the signing ceremony was happening on the White House lawn, do you know what was playing on, I won't mention the channels, on Canadian media? NAFTA, free trade agreement. The most important, significant event in our time was happening. Wow. And Canadians were watching something on NAFTA.
Good Lord.
And that's unfortunately the skewed bias of Canadian media about positive things that happen in the Middle East. If you switch on Canadian media now, it's all negative. Well, what about all the positive things?
Absolutely. Before we hear more, we're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and Avi Ben-Lolo when we come back.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, we are back. This is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, FM 96.7. And I just wanted to talk to you, Avi, about ceasefire, the word ceasefire. So I'll never forget when Hillary Clinton did this beautiful video and said, "Hi, guys, we had a ceasefire on October 6th. Hamas broke that ceasefire." And then you hear on these college campuses, especially at the beginning, ceasefire, ceasefire. So Israel has made numerous attempts at saying, "Let's do a ceasefire. We're willing to give you this." And they're giving way more than Hamas is giving. And every one of those suggestions has been rejected. Can you speak about that? But let's just talk about this word ceasefire and how Israel had a ceasefire.
Yeah, look, as you say, of course, Israel had a ceasefire with Hamas. Hamas, on its own initiative, unprovoked, broke the ceasefire on October 7th, attacked Israel, murdered 1,200 people, not only murdered, but it was even in the way that it was done. I think it really needs to be said, going into small villages surrounding Gaza, going into people's homes and murdering entire families, you know, parents with their children, in just the most brutal way. You know, I can't even imagine being in the position of seeing my kids murdered in front of me. And some were raped in front of their parents. You know, just horrendous, horrendous things. So Hamas broke the ceasefire, but not just broke it by firing rockets, assaulted Israelis. And so, you know, it needs to be understood that. So when the world is now calling for a ceasefire after Hamas committed these atrocities, and Israel has, by every legal definition, you know, international legal definition, the right to go in and finish off Hamas, to ensure the safety and security of its own citizens, it must do that. You know, now the world, of course, is objecting, which is something that is so ridiculous. Hamas, since then, of course, has rejected many ceasefire attempts by Israel. Hamas, of course, kidnapped initially over 250 Israelis and other nationals, and now is still holding on to what we think is 133 Israelis, but probably has already murdered most of them, and now the numbers are much lower. No one really knows the exact numbers. Israel is once again, for what, the 20th time, offering a new peace deal, a new ceasefire deal for the return of something like 30 hostages, which is, again, a
low
ridiculous
number. Yeah.
Number. And so Hamas is once again not willing to do that and drag its feet. Why? Because Hamas's ultimate objective, it doesn't matter. Remember, this is a religious-based organization. This is not a political organization with any normal logic. Okay, when you are inspired by religion and dying for your religion is actually what we would say in Hebrew, a mitzvah,
like a good, righteous thing.
Right. That is what they believe. If I die for this cause, it's actually a really good deed. It's a really good thing. That is a religious belief that Hamas has. And you can't rationalize with that belief. That is a jihadi Islamist belief. ISIS had it. Taliban has it. Al-Qaeda had it. All of these organizations share in the same belief, the religious belief, to murder their enemies, the infidels. And so there's no rationalization. And you have, you know, the public has to understand that. So you can't negotiate with people who have that kind of belief within their system. And Israel's trying to do a rational approach, but it's still not working. And so, the calling of the ceasefire, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen. At the end of the day, the Israeli public, of course, wants Hamas finished off. Hamas itself wants Israel finished off. And so, you know, there's a stalemate.
You know, the other thing I just want to say is that people keep saying pro-Palestinian rallies, but what I've read about is that it's really a pro-Hamas rally, and Hamas's charter is to kill Jews. Like that, there is no, correct me if I'm wrong in this, like when they say there is only one solution, Intifada revolution, from the rivers to the sea, Palestine will be free. And from the river to sea does mean killing all Jews, not only Israel, but all over the world. People don't know this. So please correct me. Am I understanding the word intifada to mean what it means and what they are asking for? Eradicating Jews, which is very disturbing, certainly to Jewish students and to their parents and to the Jewish world, but I think to everyone who has a heart. So,
yes, I think it's clear, you know, when you test the question of many activists, particularly the ones that are not from the region, and you say, you know, what do you think from the river to the sea actually means? Do you understand what that means? They don't know. They don't understand that it's the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea, which is the state of Israel. And so they're chanting these chants that essentially mean the genocide of the Jewish people.
That's right.
And so it's unfortunately, these young people on university campuses, they don't really understand who they're aligning with, what they're chanting about. They haven't delved into it. When you ask them, they believe they're standing up for somebody who is oppressed. They don't understand they're standing up for a terrorist group, and Hamas is a terrorist group. So what is required here is a lot more education. The media itself, you know, when you have some in the media call Hamas militants instead of terrorists, that's a problem because they're not militants, okay? These are terrorists with an objective to eradicate another people. They conducted suicide bombings. They fire indiscriminately rockets into cities. We saw what they did on October the 7th. So all the evidence is there. And so, you know, I'm hoping that many of your listeners who may have not understood this, take a step back and understand the truth and the reality about what is going on, where you have a terrorist group like Hamas attacking a free and democratic nation with the very same values of Canada, of what we have, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, you know, women's rights, gay rights, has the only gay parades, pride parades in the area. No other country has in the Middle East. You know, so when you look at all of that and you look at the evidence, if you're standing and you're a neutral person, just look at these facts and look at the evidence and then decide for yourself which side you would rather be on.
You know, okay, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. This is going to affect the whole world. If anything happens to Israel, we have to protect Israel because this is not just for Jewish people and for Israelis. This is for the world. Can you speak to that? Because I think that's something people don't get.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Israel's democracy is incredible. Again, a lot of people don't know, but there's 2 million Arabs that live in Israel. They have every single right that any other Jewish person has. They vote in Israel's parliament. They have representatives in Israel's parliament. The last political party, actually, they had an Arab party in coalition with the government. When you visit, and I visit Israel, you know, I'm going again on Friday. When you visit Israel, if you go to the hospital, you know, God forbid, but if you have to go for anything, you will see Arab physicians and nurses standing side by side with Jewish physicians. You will see Arab police officers. You will see them in the legal system. They are intertwined in the fabric of Israeli society. And that shows you, you know, when Israel is called an apartheid state, there's no apartheid in Israel. You know, you see the Arab families, if you're on the Tel Aviv beach, you see the Arab families walking alongside the Jewish families. It's actually quite incredible and it's refreshing. And nowhere in the Middle East do you see anything like that. You certainly, Jews are not in any parliament in the Middle East. So, you know, so Israel is really an incredible country that needs to be preserved for those reasons. Does it have security issues? Of course. Does it have, you know, barriers like any other country that protects its security? Just like any other country, immigration, you know, barriers? Of course it does. But within Israel, you know, the Arab community thrives, has very substantial cities. If you drive through, you'll see them, and are going to Israeli universities and are becoming educated and professionals. And that's Israeli democracy. It's really a beautiful place.
I agree. I was just there actually about 6 weeks ago, and I am with you on this. I know we sort of touched on this, but why do you think that the pro-Palestinian movement has become the darling of the so-called woke left?
Yeah, look, as I started, the woke left, you know, has been working hard to undermine the society that we've built. They have felt underprivileged in this society and marginalized. And so, you know, they've been working hard to undermine that. And so they have now, you know, consorted with the Palestinian movement because they feel, you know, that they're aligning with a similar movement that feels the same way. You know, the problem, of course, with that is that, you know, the people who are woke, so to speak, are also about, you know, gay rights. They're also about women's rights. They believe in anti-discrimination. And what they unfortunately fail to understand is if they were to take their values and transplant them, whether it's to the West Bank or to Gaza or to most other Muslim countries.
Game over.
Yeah, it'd be game over. They wouldn't be able to. The only place in the Middle East that they would thrive is Israel.
That's right.
That's what's funny about it. And that actually what leads us to believe that their behavior is anti-Semitic, because when it's not logical, when there's no logic to their behavior, there's just one reason, and it's anti-Semitic. Their hatred for the Jewish people, for whatever it is, it could be a historic hatred, you know, for whatever reason, they unfortunately have taken that and they've put it at the top of their list and said, well, you know what, I hate the Jewish people more than, you know, I believe in human rights and women's rights and so forth. And so I will do everything I can to disrupt and destroy Israel and mislabel it and, you know, and do these campaigns against it.
We're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and Avi Ben-Lolo when we come back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, and I've been talking with Avi Ben-Lolo. Facebook CEO made a big milestone in the fight against Holocaust denial when he believed and agreed with an idea that has been said for many years that there's a direct link between anti-Semitism and violence, which is what we're seeing on these campuses. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, look, I mean, he actually resisted for many, many years. We had back and forth. And I mean, we, the Jewish community, and even Holocaust survivors, you know, there was a lot of anti-Semitism on Facebook, a lot of Holocaust denial. And, you know, we had a lot of concerns because this is going, you know, the problem is on social media, and we're seeing it on TikTok, we're seeing it on Instagram, on LinkedIn, and on Twitter, on X. the anti-Semitism on social media is very serious. It's actually very serious. You know, whereas once you had white supremacist groups going and putting up posters on polls and trying to recruit students and so forth, now in milliseconds, you can impact millions of people on mm-hmm. social media through mm-hmm. false information about, so-called Jewish conspiracies and all these manifestations mm-hmm. of anti-Semitism. Even during COVID, lots of manifestations of anti-Semitism took place. And then, of course, when things heat up, as they are right now in the Middle East, anti-Semitism is huge on social media. So it's a massive problem for the Jewish world, whereas once we were dealing with anti-Semitic attacks here and there and so-called, now it's a tsunami. And that's because social media has been just so empowering of hatred. And by the way, I would add, it's not just hatred towards Jews. You'll see hatred against many other groups, the Black community, the Asian community, the gay community. So you see that on social media, just amplified. So in terms of Facebook, look, we challenged Zuckerberg. Holocaust survivors went to see him to explain to him. He finally had relented and backed away and created some AI to stop the flow as much as possible. Problem is, of course, that there's other social media that we haven't gotten control over, and I doubt we'll ever be able to, but the numbers of anti-Semitism is just skyrocketing, and the solutions are not easy.
I really felt a chill when I saw the broken glass at Columbia University, and it took me back to when you talked about Kristallnacht, which of course refers to Germany's Night of Broken Glass on November 9th to 10th in 1938, when Nazi leaders released a series of pogroms against the Jewish population in Germany. It became known as the Night of Broken Glass because of the shattered glass that littered the streets after the vandalism of Jewish-owned businesses and synagogues and homes. And you really do an exceptional job of talking about some of the devastating events that have happened to the Jewish people throughout the ages. And it seems that we had a bit of a reprieve after 1948. So to what do you attribute this tremendous surge? To what do you attribute to this unbridled torrent of anti-Semitism that is happening right now? And of course, how do we combat it and return to some kind of normalcy?
Yeah, look, I mean, to your point, I think after the Holocaust, and especially I have to say my generation, you know, and I don't have to say how old I am, but I always reflect on this with my friends, and we believe that we lived through probably the best time in Jewish history, where as kids living in this country, we hadn't mm-hmm. felt anti-Semitism. That's the truth. Yeah. There was no anti-Semitism. And I had friends and of every single culture and persuasion, and we all got along growing up, and there was never, mm-hmm. ever a feeling of it. And it was such a beautiful time. And it still is. Mm-hmm. Those people still exist. So, you know, we really lived through the honeymoon period post-Holocaust when all of this was happening. Obviously, in the last 20 years, things have been accelerating, and as is the case in Jewish history, you know, we think that we are the only ones living in anti-Semitism. Well, Theodor Herzl, the father of the Jewish state, he was trying to find a solution to anti-Semitism in the late 1800s. Why? Because in France and in Europe, anti-Semitism was rampant. And, you know, I won't get into the Dreyfus, Alfred Dreyfus story, but anti-Semitism at that time was rampant, and he was looking for a solution. Yes. The same question you just asked. He was looking. So the solution that he came up with is the Jewish state. The Jewish people need a place of refuge to escape anti-Semitism. That's the truth. And so fighting for the Jewish state and fighting for its survival and ensuring that it's our lifeboat
mandatory.
Is integral. Yeah, and if we didn't have a Jewish state today, it would be far, far worse. I can guarantee you that.
In the book, a lot of this you say can be traced back to Nazism, which, as you write, was a calculated strategy designed to marginalize and dehumanize Jews. And while Hitler and the Nazis may be gone, their ideology survives and in some cases thrives. And you write with all this in mind, and I quote, "We have much to be concerned about, everything from online hate to even the mainstream media revealing often anti-Semitic beliefs and complicity and cooperation in the face of evil." And the social media has obviously contributed to this out of control wildfire, as are many other things. So is what's different now than what we had before the fact that we have, that there is an Israel, that an Israel does exist? Is that what makes this time in history different from that time ultimately?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference that we have a place and a country that stands up for us and our people and gives us strength. On the other hand, you know, we've all heard the term, or some of your listeners may have heard the term, the new anti-Semitism. The new anti-Semitism is tied to the state of Israel. So, you know, the new anti-Semitism now, whereas once they attacked the Jewish people, now they attack the Jewish state as the embodiment of the Jewish people. That is the body now of the Jewish people. So, you know, they no longer just attack the Jewish people individually in their communities. Now they're attacking the Jewish state. And that is the new anti-Semitism. And it's a very, very important to recognize. There's only one Jewish state. There's only less than 16, most of your listeners would not know this, 16 million Jews. Think about it. In a world population of over 8 billion, maybe even close to 9 billion, only 16 million Jewish people in the world today, only one Jewish state amongst 193 states at the United Nations, okay? And it's the one state that is attacked the most at the United Nations and in the world. So then for your listeners, ask yourself the most rational questions, why that is. Why that is. Why isn't Syria, who gassed 500,000 of their own people? Why isn't Iran, that hangs gay people and executes their own people and represses women? Why isn't North Korea? We can go on. Why isn't China, that is imprisoning the Uyghur population? Why aren't they in the spotlight? But only Israel is. Because it's anti-Semitism.
What is anti-Semitism? Okay, we can unpack that word. Why anti-Semitism? Like, it doesn't make sense to me. What is this age-old?
Well, first of all, it's for those who don't know, anti-Semitism is obviously just plainly hatred of the Jewish people. Okay, so that's what some people call it Jew hate. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is anti-Semitism is an interesting. You have to understand the history of anti-Semitism, where it's from, how it arose, etc. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism came out of the Christian world. And I hate to say it because we have great relationship with the Christian community right now, but in Christian liturgy, we were accused for nearly 2,000 years of killing Jesus. And that was taught, you know, it's called deicide. It was taught in the Catholic Church and in many churches. And so, unfortunately, that's been infused in the religion. And that's why there was the Spanish Inquisition, for example. That's why there were Crusades. That's why the Romans went in and destroyed Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. So that has been the history of anti-Semitism. Sadly enough, it also influenced, you know, the Arab world in the same way. But the Arab world became much more anti-Semitic following the establishment of the State of Israel. The Arab world still, and you had the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem during Hitler's time align himself with Adolf Hitler. And so Nazism also, believe it or not, impacted the Arab world. In fact, a lot of Nazi pamphlets and Mein Kampf and so forth were just found in Gaza during this war. So you have to understand, unfortunately, that this ideology and this permeation of ideology, which always changes, it's almost like a virus.
Mutate.
That continues to shift and change.
Yeah.
And mutate according to the time and place. And that is what anti-Semitism is. And it can be traced back to 2,000 years ago and throughout the ages.
It has to be combated, and I hope we're going to help find the solution. You talk about how while the Abraham Accords signaled great positivity in the region, there's still a great need to counter delegitimization campaigns against Israel, especially for those who believe in freedom and democracy. You write about how Israel's celebrity, Noah Tishbe, the country's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and delegitimization, underscores the importance of defending democracies. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, Israel, unfortunately, as I said, you know, has been defamed and undermined in many ways at the United Nations and through very vigorous campaigns against the idea of Zionism itself. You know, many try to call Zionism racism. It's not racism. Almost every community and nationality of people have struggled to be free and to be liberated. And you see liberation movements all over the world. Zionism is just the Jewish liberation movement. That's all it is. It's just coming back to your own homeland. So, you know, unfortunately, whether it's at the United Nations or internationally or on university campuses, which we're seeing now, there is an effort to defame Israel, delegitimize it, undermine it, in an effort to really destroy the country as it is. And that's the problem. So you have people, a lot of activists, you know, you mentioned Noah Tishbe, there are many more, and we're all out there fighting every single day, trying to bring a little bit of truth to this very dark world at this point, you know, which is why I have to say I appreciate shows like yours that are, you know, bringing the truth out to listeners. And I also hope that listeners think for themselves and really research themselves and try to understand things on their own, to try to educate themselves and to understand the truth of the reality, which is Israel is a great place. It's really a beacon of hope and democracy. It's the only one in the Middle East.
You say that Israel is the answer to anti-Semitism. Like in 20 words or less, how so?
Israel's the answer to anti-Semitism. It's the refuge. It's the Jewish refuge. If Jews need to run away from anti-Semitism, if Israel had existed prior to the Holocaust, there would be no Holocaust, right? And anti-Semitism was the reason for the Holocaust. And so that is the ultimate answer to anti-Semitism. And it's the ultimate reinforcer of Jewish right to live, to exist, like anyone else in this world.
I actually saw an Instagram post recently, pink writing on a black background, and it reads, if black students, Asian students, LGBTQ plus students, or Muslim students were barred from entering parts of their campus because of their identity, in this case, it was a Jewish identity, how long would it take for you to speak out? I am seriously asking this question. People have to think about that question.
Well, I mean, I just want to tell you on the International Criminal Court situation, the court has said now that it wants to indict Jewish leaders like Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's a joke. When you think about Hamas and its leaders who orchestrated what is really what was the biggest event since the Holocaust against the Jews, they haven't been indicted for war crimes. How is that possible? So then you start understanding, which is what I said before, the double standards against Israel and the Jewish people. It's just wrong.
When I asked a very knowledgeable relative who's going to come and save the day, where's our Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King or Gandhi, who is going to save the day? He said, we are. Mm-hmm. The Jewish people are going to save themselves.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of heartbreaking and kind of true. In a lot of ways. You write that we have a mutual responsibility to carry out God's will to repair the world, which in Hebrew is called Tikkun Olam. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, the Jewish people, if you look at actually many human rights organizations, they were started by Jewish people. When you look at the civil rights movement, it was Jewish people that supported Martin Luther King Jr. When you look at refugees, even we had Syrian refugees coming here, Jewish people in synagogues were supporting them. In fact, I'll tell you, when Assad was gassing kids, and we saw those images on television, I organized a press conference with Holocaust survivors, and we were all crying, pleading with him to stop. Jewish people are always on the front lines of trying to do what is right, of trying to make the world a better place. And that is the absolute truth. And for us, even while there's devastation in Gaza and Israel has to go in and fight Hamas, and I agree with that, it's heartbreaking for us to see some of the images. You know, we don't want to see it. I mean, you know, it's important for your listeners to understand that we don't want that to happen to the innocent people there. And it's heartbreaking for every single Jewish person to see it. But we also recognize that we're freeing them from Hamas. okay, yeah, that they are not living good lives under Hamas. And so, you know, we believe that tikkun olam, repair of the world, is our mission in life. That's why we were put on this planet, yeah, to try to make it a better place. And so the Jewish community has always been at the forefront of every single civil rights movement in the world.
Absolutely. You know, there's so much we could talk about the hostages being released. Will that happen? Do you see this happening soon? My heart breaks for people like Rachel Goldberg Pollan, Hirsch Goldberg Pollan's mother and father. When will this happen? How will this happen? Is it possible?
Yeah, it's very hard to know. It's a hard question to answer because Hamas is a death squad. It's basically, you know, it surrounded itself with these hostages, and they want the Israeli commandos to come in and to murder them on the spot. And that's what Israel has resisted doing, knowing this for a fact. So it's hard to know for sure. Everybody's hoping for like a ceasefire. One can happen as we speak with the release of the hostages. That's what we're always praying for every single day.
Yes.
But it needs to happen with also international pressure.
You know, even if the hostages are released, and I know we can go on and on, there's also the question of how are they ever going to get over this collective grief, the families of the hostages, people all over the world. There's a collective grief that goes along with everything, not to mention, and you briefly touched on this, the women's movement. We have proof in videos and photographs that many women on October 8th, we actually have very disturbing proof. Some people have seen these videos. Some journalists have chosen not to see them. Not only were they brutally raped and tortured, but they continue to be in Gaza in the tunnels. Why have women's groups been asleep at the wheel? Where is everyone?
Yeah, I was involved in one case where someone on a university campus who was the director of the Women's Harassment Center signed a document, a letter, actually suggesting that the rapes didn't happen. And so this denial, thankfully, she was let go for having said that. But, you know, these denials continue to happen. They are shameful. Women's groups who have yet to condemn or condemned late should be ashamed of themselves. And so, you know, these stories are coming out. Sheryl Sandberg just put out a documentary on it, which I would encourage people to watch. And we have to keep the world advised of what actually took place.
The book is so wonderful. Why did you title the book Never Surrender?
Because it speaks for itself. We just cannot surrender to this terrorism, to Hamas, to hateful people. We are on the front line and we are holding these gates, okay? These gates of these people coming in. And we're doing it, by the way, for the rest of society. They don't know it. They don't realize it. But we are doing it for them. What we are doing on campus and what we've been doing on university campus all these years is holding down back these floodgates. Okay, and we're doing it also in Israel. The IDF is holding them back. And once they break through, you know, in every society where, you know, the Jews are first to be attacked, and when they're attacked, the rest of society suffers eventually. You know, during World War II, nearly 60 million people were killed because Adolf Hitler was not stopped at the gates.
Right.
He went after the Jews and he murdered 6 million, but through that process, almost 60 million people were killed in action and as civilians, etc. And so we're right on the front lines all the time, but we can't do it alone. We're not going to surrender ever. We're going to continue fighting, but we need everybody's help to stand with us.
Absolutely. There's a question, Avi, that we ask everyone at the end of the show, and I'm not even sure it's appropriate to ask this question for this episode, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Oh, no.
Sorry. In a perfect world, what is bliss for Avi Ben-Lolo?
In a perfect world, in terms of my work in this discussion, you know, it would be a state of Israel that lives peacefully amongst its neighbors, where we can all, you know, fly into our neighboring nations, the Arab nations, whether it's Egypt or Turkey or Syria or wherever it is, and they can come to Israel and be happy together, and there would be an end to the fighting. Palestinians themselves, you know, can live happily in their own state, peacefully with the state of Israel. I've always advocated that for that, you know, in my entire career. And so that really would be bliss for me to see that happening, where we can all be on Tel Aviv beach together enjoying the sun and the water. And that's bliss for me.
And a good falafel.
And a good falafel together.
And a good falafel.
Exactly. Exactly. As my good friend Neil says, make hummus, not war.
Yeah, exactly. I want to thank you for this time. Yeah. I really think this show is all about what you're doing, is trying to make the world a better place. And I thank you for that. What is the best way for people to contact you and connect with you on social media? And of course, to get a copy of your book.
Well, our website is agpiworld.com. So you go on our website, and, you know, also it's a good website for articles and information and news updates about what's going on in the world, what we're doing. That's probably the best way. And I'm on every single social media channel there is. So just find my name.
Thank you, Avi.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Avi Ben-Lolo, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to the Finding Your Bliss team, Zoomer Radio, and the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.